So thanks for having me. First of all, I want to apologize because I heard I was like a couple days ago, and then I got a call saying, would you like to give a talk? And the answer in my head was no, but I said yes. So so this is just a potpourri of all the stuff I could put together at the very last minute of things that I work on. And by the way, in case you haven't heard, the Center for Gravitational Wave Physics at Penn State has not been refunded, so that's what the defunct means. So that means kind of a sad thing. But here is the roadmap of stuff I would like to talk about if I had a chance to do it for a very long time. I don't think I'll get a chance to talk about all of them. But since it's a potpourri, I thought it would be a good idea to give you a roadmap so you know where I'm going. First things first, this is not published anywhere, but I kind of just want to tell you something that I've been thinking about galactic nuclei and what the appropriate physics to think about is over the range of galactic nuclei. So I'm going to talk about that first. And then we'll talk about a new mechanism for intercluster flight from binary black hole ejection. Stein talked about that a little bit. Were you all here for that? Okay. So it's not completely crazy to cover a little bit. And then what would happen during these fast flybys of stars with black holes? Well, we're going to talk about the gravitational wave signal that you could have from that. And then I also want to talk about, if we have time, the issue of non-axis symmetry and loss cone refilling. But I kind of moved it down here because if you're a galaxy dynamicist, it's kind of boring because you know it already and you fall asleep almost talking about it. And if you're a stellar dynamicist, you kind of think it's not important for your routine. So we'll talk about whether it is important or not in the introduction here. But if you're interested in the topic or you're skeptical about whether non-axis symmetry is important and whether it can refill a loss cone, and I don't get to it today, please come visit me because there's lots to say about it. Oh, and then something I just worked on yesterday, we're going to talk about which we probably won't get to, but come visit me if you're interested. We're going to talk about the increase in the Emery rate from binary star disruption in a triaxial system. So I've got a rate for that in a little plot. Okay, so first things first. This plot was kind of inspired by some ideas that people have been bandying around, one plot in particular from Merritt and Zell in the past year, plots the relaxation time scale at the radius and influence of the black hole as a function of the magnitude of the galaxy. So this kind of tells, what it tells you is typically bright galaxies are collision less, so their relaxation time scale at the radius of influence is quite long, longer than a Hubble time, and the relaxation time scale for faint galaxies is much shorter, so you can use collisional processes, and you have to worry about mass segregation and that sort of thing. So that may be embedded in your mind in general. And so if you're thinking about processes like the Emery rate, where you typically have low-mass black holes, and you think low-mass black holes typically live in low-luminosity systems, you want to think mostly about collisional systems, right? But I've kind of been wondering about that for some time now, because of course there's a range of black hole masses given a particular luminosity. And so I've always kind of wondered whether we're considering the right physics. So I made this plot yesterday. This is for a number of galaxies that we have measured black hole masses for. The black hole masses are taken from Ferri, C, and Merritt, and I calculated the relaxation time scale at a very small radius, well inside the radius of influence, at 0.01 parsec. Now that is a big caveat, right? Because you have to extrapolate from the smallest measured density profile, smallest measured velocity dispersion, and you have to assume for this little calculation that all the stars have about 0.7 solar masses, but caveat, 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 blah, blah, blah. Here is the relaxation time for all of those galaxies. And then I've color-coded them as to whether or not the relaxation time at this very small radius is longer than the Hubble time or not. And so the blue are longer than Hubble time, red are shorter than the Hubble time. So these are collision-less nuclei, these are collision-full nuclei. And then I wanted to talk about what range of black hole mass is important for LISA observations of Emery's. Okay? And so it's an estimate. I guess you can go all the way up to 10 to the 7 if you have a certain type of black hole, right? Rapidly spinning pair black hole. But let's just take this range. And in that range, there's a startling thing that happened, which is that, okay, here, this is the Milky Way. There's M32 and another galaxy here. There are a couple galaxies that are collisional and a couple galaxies that aren't. M31's right on the edge, so you might want to push it down. But this one's in order of magnitude higher, so it's quite collision-less. And that's a big deal, because that means that even, so first of all, there are two types of galactic nuclei, and when you're in this regime, you absolutely have to not worry about mass segregation, relaxation, blah, blah, blah. You're working in the collisionless Boltzmann equation kind of regime. And that certainly occurs for things like binary black hole mergers, large binary black hole mergers, et cetera. But even if you're in this low luminosity regime, there are some times where if you worry about mass segregation, you're worried about the wrong thing. You're incorporating the wrong kind of physics, because there are some galaxies for which that's absolutely not important. Okay, so that was me picking a fight.
For all of them, 10 solar mass black holes, their spiral time is shorter than the Hubble time.
Yeah.
You don't have any above 3 10 to the 7 that are above 10 to the 11 here.
Sorry, you're saying if we were to go to 10 solar masses, 10
right,
solar mass black holes, because the relaxation rate.
That's the dominant Emery rate, and they're self-gravitating well inside that radius. So that part of the physics is okay. If you were just at 0.4,
yep.
Martin,
that's right. Yep. So that was a bit of a way to pick a fight. And I just wanted to say, probably, if I think the real thing to worry about, though, is sort of this intermediate regime, where people have been talking about hybrid approaches of adding like an SCF code with relaxation terms or direct n-body inside some kind of tree code, because both of these processes are important. The galaxy shape, the overall potential is important, and there are some relaxation processes. So that's...
Do you evaluate the relaxation under its radius or the radius of influence, or where is it evaluated?
It's evaluated at this radius. I just wanted to go quite close. You can also evaluate it at the radius of influence, and people have done that. I just extrapolated closer in, because you can easily argue that as you go closer in a cuspy density profile, that the relaxation time decreases. Sorry, there'll always be some radius at which...
If you have a power law profile.
Quite a few of these galaxies aren't a power law profile, and these galaxies with the power law profile, even quite close...
Power law isn't always some radius where the relaxation time becomes...
Not necessarily.
Depends on the extent.
Right.
It's steeper than 1.5, which is what I've known plus 1. And then the theory is... Because the shorter and shorter, actually...
Yep. Which is why this happens.
So can I just ask, though, if you were to, I mean, this is true at this very small radius, but if you go out a factor of 10 or 100 to the influence range,
it's even worse. Yeah.
Well, it depends. I don't know what she assumed at the cusp. I mean, if it's all, as you say, all of these is way inside the radius of influence, so mm-hmm. it's only changing very the relaxation time. If it's minus 1.75 cusp, it's changing kind of slowly.
It can be a factor of 5 or 7 galactic center.
Right. But I don't know which galaxies those are. I mean, in the Milky Way, in M32, which could be a measured one, it's less, it's much less than a Hubble plot at those radii. And I don't know what the other points are. They must be.
Yes, these are M31 and in the Milky Way, and they're
so these other
appropriate.
Ones must be some dwarf in MGC 4365 or something.
That's one of these. This one's M31, and it's right on the edge. So
M31 is 2^10 of a 7 solar mass. It can't possibly be M31.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, it was right over here. Yeah. Oh, sorry, but it's right on the edge. That was my point. It's right on the edge. Waistband. So I was thinking about how to move things this way. So yeah, I've got them typed if you want them. Yeah.
Well, just as a follow up on this point, in terms of relaxation and mass segregation, one could just say that the mass segregation timescale is something like the heavy mass over the average mass,
yep,
times the standard relaxation time.
Yep.
No, opposite time. The factor you get is that. So that can be. So therefore, you get dynamical friction as some part of relaxation. So you can get relaxation effects on a much shorter timescale, mm-hmm, if you have a range,
yep,
between the heavy and the low masses.
Yes. I guess my point is this is. Yes, there are caveats to this, and the relaxation time itself can change. It goes with 1 over m, so if you change the mass spectrum as well, that will change. So so it's surprising that we've got an order of magnitude over a Hubble time for quite close into the black hole for some even low luminosity galaxies. So I think that argues more for a hybrid approach than anything else. All right. So I think even though I started a bit of an argument, the galaxy shape and the structure matters. And the way in which it matters, at least in the collision-less case, is that it changes the orbital structure. So this is quite well known. Basically, you just funnel material close to the black hole from centrifugal orbits. In a non-axis symmetric case or in an anisotropic case, you can also do that as well. You introduce new mechanisms for transporting material through phase space. This is well known in terms of chaotic orbits. And late in the talk, if we have time, you can also just transport material through angular momentum space because orbits don't necessarily have to conserve angular momentum. Right. So that was just me standing on a soapbox and saying that the shape of the background potential matters when you do these calculations, even in the low luminosity regime. So switching topics, one thing I want to talk about is how supermassive black holes can seed the intercluster medium with hypervelocity stars. And this is something that I worked on and is on AstroPH. As you know, you can have three-body encounters with a binary black hole, and when you do, the star takes energy and angular momentum from the system and gets a kick. And the average velocity change, well, the average velocity acceleration, is depends upon the separation of the two black holes and the masses. That's just the average. There's a tail in either direction. So the question, though, is in a non-equilibrium galaxy cluster potential, would the distribution of stars that receive these kicks be identifiable in any way or separable in any way from the regular kind of tidally stripped intercluster light? And so for that, we wanted to explore this in a cluster context. So if this were to happen in M87, typically you can assume 10^9 solar mass initial black hole. You can an average, if there were a binary black hole, would most likely have a 10^1 mass ratio-ish. And so if it were hard, it would have a 2 parsec separation. And that would give you an average velocity of about 1,300 kilometers a second. Certainly well fast enough to get out of M87. There's a tail on either side. I'll show you the probability distribution for that. If you wanted to calculate the amount of mass that would occur from the hardening phase all the way down to the gravitational radiation phase during the entire hardening phase, This is the amount of masses ejected, and it's about 6 times 10 to the 9 solar masses, or about 2% of the luminosity of M87. That assumes that the lost cone is full and that you you follow the entire evolution during this hardening phase, so that's over the whole hardening phase. However, typically you eject most of the mass at the initial part of the hardening phase, so most of the mass gets ejected quite quickly, and then as the cross-section, as the orbit shrinks, the cross-section goes down, and so you eject much fewer particles later in the phase.
So that velocity is at the initial stage, then is that velocity you quoted there, that's the beginning of the hardening?
That's the average velocity at the beginning of the hardening, yeah.
But that must be ordered as the escape velocity from the main, so.
So, yeah, it's a little bit higher than that, but yeah. It's not completely different than that. Okay, so this is what would happen if this process were occurring in M87. And if you were to scale up to the entire Virgo cluster, well, you take the number of galaxies in the Virgo cluster, you assume, let's pretend, that each galaxy had only one and only one supermassive black hole binary of that mass ratio per galaxy per Hubble time, which is a bit of an assumption. And then you determine the mass of the supermassive black hole from M sigma, and so on, and you can calculate analytically that that anywhere between 4 and 20% of the intercluster light could be from these processes. So it could be a significant fraction of the total intercluster light that you see could come from this process.
Well, there is an assumption of what kind of stars are ejected then, right?
No, you just
said... If it's all white dwarfs, then you don't get any contribution to the concern.
If it were all white dwarfs, but the tidal disruption radius is still pretty small, so you could have a main sequence star passing 2 parsecs away from the from a large supermassive black hole that could get ejected still. So these are not just white dwarfs.
Stars are black holes because they have mass segregated too close to the binary black hole, and those are ejected.
If that were true, yeah, but it would be unlikely that would happen.
Yeah.
Right, because this is stuff coming from a large radius. You haven't yet, but we would like to.
Sorry,
mm-hmm.
You actually looked at the cores of the Virgo galaxy, the brighter ones, and saw how much light is removed.
Yeah. Your mass deficits.
Exactly. I think that has been done, in fact. All right. So again, those were sort of analytic estimates of how much you ought to expect. The question really is, would this be in any way discernible within a cluster potential? So we happen to have known some people who and were working on intercluster light that was tidally stripped. So we have this cosmological simulation of about 10 million particles of about 50 megaparsec cube. From Z of 50 to 0, then you go back to, you identify a 10 to the 14 solar mass halo, go back to Z of 2, pick out all the halos in there, put equilibrium galaxies inside each halo according to the halo occupation function, and then run it back to 0 of 0 again. So that's what this little movie is. So all this sort of fuzzy stuff is tidally stripped intercluster light material. And from these simulations and others, about 10 to 50% of the intercluster light in a galaxy cluster is tidally stripped stuff. And that's this. This is at a surface brightness too faint to see. What we can identify observationally is just this stuff.
What do you think the rest is?
Pardon?
You said about 10 to 50% is tidally stripped, so you must have a source for the rest.
The 10 to 50% of the galaxy light is intercluster light. 4 to 20% could be from this other process. Yeah. Sorry. All right, so clearly with a cosmological simulation, you don't have good resolution. Our resolution was a kiloparsec even when we zoomed in. So we wanted to throw in some of these slingshot ejections, But we wouldn't have been able to do it in a proper way, right? We wouldn't be able to do it dynamically because we don't have the resolution to cover that. So what we did was we mocked it up. We took the probability distribution function of ejection at a particular velocity as a function of the binary. And this is adapted from a figure in Quinlan 1986. So you can see there's a peak velocity. That was at 1350 kilometers a second that I was talking about. But there's a distribution, and there's a tail, right? So what we did, we started with that cluster simulation. We identified a large halo. We identified a region in that large halo and a particular size that corresponded to the separation of a pretend binary black hole at the center, okay? And then we put a couple thousand tracer particles close to the center, gave them a small velocity, random positions, so that they would, and when they eventually passed within this pretend binary black hole separation, we gave them a kick that had a velocity drawn from this probability distribution function. Okay. And then the only time you received something that wasn't self-consistent was at that time, and afterwards and beforewards, the system was self-consistent. All right, so here is a projected distance and velocity of the simulation after, I think, 10 million years, so it's quite short. The red dots are bound galaxy structures or bound halo structures. There's some green you might be able to see. That is that tidally stripped material, so that's the commonly known intercluster light. This blue stuff, which is not perfectly well defined in a ring, so there's that tail of low velocity stuff, and there's the high velocity stuff, is the slingshot ejections from binary black holes. So first of all, it's at typically, not always, but can be at very high velocities and should be able to be easily picked out in a statistical way.
I guess that ring, this was a short simulation, so the black hole radius hadn't changed very much, so they were mostly being kicked out of that narrow velocity. If it had shrunk over 10 billion years by a factor of 4, then you would have smeared the ring.
Not necessarily. A little bit, but not entirely. First of all, as it shrinks, the cross-section shrinks, so there are fewer stars that are ejected. So most of the ejection occurs right at the hardening radius. A sub bullet, which is what I was talking about. But the other thing is the later stars are faster on average, and so they catch up. So it will smear it a bit, but the two sort of main points, which is the later stars are faster and the later stars are fewer, mean that you're not going to smear this a lot. Does that make sense?
It just looks like most of your stars are between 1,500 to 1,400 kilometers a second.
Yeah, that corresponds to that.
By a factor of 2, you only change the cross section by 2, and it's going to be
a geometrical cross section, but yeah.
This is from one galaxy, right?
That's so from one galaxy.
Not for many galaxies computer to you, get a whole.
You get a big mess. We want to explore the big mess, but first we have to convince our referees, because rightly so. The very first thing we did was we threw all these stars out at 1350, so the ring was infinitely thin and infinitely flat, which I'll show you the flatness in a second. And gosh, that wasn't the right thing to do. So he or she said, nah. So now we threw it out in this a little better. So hopefully it likes that. So as soon as this passes muster, we'll be doing the more complicated part. And the other issue too, which isn't such a big deal, because these are thrown out ballistically, basically. But the potential evolves, right? So this torus should be persistent, but there'll be a lot of mixing from other galaxies.
So there is one assumption here that the shrinking of the orbit of the binary black hole is purely determined by these high-velocity stars.
Yes, there's no gas, no anything. But we don't do it self-consistent. We don't change the.
We did the simulation. Where we do it self-consistently, we don't get a ring. And I'm thinking, why do we not get a ring and you do get a ring? The parameter space, of course, is completely different, right? We have 100,000 particles or so,
I think,
and two black holes, and they spiral in, and we
my guess,
mess, become a mess.
My guess is...
Oh, it's impulsive what you do. You have one blow.
Well, I think the other issue too.
This is not really healing. This is projected on someone's
just by
unusual.
Yeah, I see the exit.
But it also is a ring in physical space, but it's thicker.
What's the mass ratio between your black hole?
That's why ding 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 ding. It's an angular minimum. It's a battle between the angular minimums, and so right. So, in a binary black hole simulation, the angular minimum in the binary supermassive black hole is much bigger than the angular minimum available to the stars, right? So I have a feeling, and I have never investigated, but I would love to, is that there's going to be a nice relation between the angular minimum available in your perturber and the angular minimum available in the slingshot. And my guess is you've got something that has a lower, ratio between those two angular minimums.
Yeah, 1,000 to 1 loss ratio.
So it would be awesome to actually look at that whole range. And I told Pau to do that for the intermediate mass black hole case, and it looks like he will.
Yes.
Absolutely. That's the other issue.
Just in the angular minimum axis. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. So, yeah, if there's any wobbling, that will smush this out as well.
But I think I understand now.
Okay, cool. Good. All right, so here's the plane. And actually, I tilted it a little bit. So I didn't want to see it edge-on. Edge-on, you see a flaring at about 40-ish degrees. So you start it towards here, and if this were edge-on, you would see material ejected out like this-ish. That angle is about 40 degrees. And the reason why this is flattened, you don't have an isotropic distribution, is because you conserve the z-component of angular minimum, or the Jacobian integral-ish. So you will get flattening of this torus. Again, we argued with our referee about that because we threw it out exactly in the plane. If you see our earlier astro-pH stuff, you'll see this ring, which is perfectly flat, and it's not. And there's a distribution. So, this is now tilted, and so you get to see some of that flaring, but not perfectly if it were flat. So, I'm arguing that it's flattened, and if you don't believe me, it's kind of like Jupiter in that Oort cloud. Right? The Oort cloud started out isotropic, and it gets a little bit flatter because of interactions just like this. Okay, so we had this idea and we did all this stuff and then we were talking about it over coffee with some observer people, which is fun to do sometimes, and they said, aha, well we have these planetary nebulae, we have these planetary nebulae in M87 and they were outliers. They were ejected here, so here is sort of a this is the distribution around M87, and this is consistent with the relaxed population. And then you have these three outliers in velocity space at about the right velocity. So we were checking to see whether the numbers work out with the number of outliers versus the fraction of intercluster light from one mechanism to the other, right, from slingshots versus tidally stripping. And that works. You also move out, if you eject at about 1,000-ish kilometers a second, to get out to 65 kiloparsecs, which is where they found these, it takes about 10 to 7 years. The lifetime of a star, that's two solar masses that would get to be a planetary nebula, is about 10 to 8 years. So you could go in as a star, get slingshot, and turn out to a planetary nebula on the way out. So the idea may actually work. And the cool thing is the kinematics is preserved and easily distinguishable. There are differences in metallicity as well between the two populations, which I'm not going to go into. The cool thing is the shape of that debris field is so distinct that you might be able to constrain in a statistical way if you had enough of these tracers, which, wow, that would be kind of difficult. But if you did, you can constrain the orbital plane of the binary black hole at, kiloparsecs. So that's pretty cool. Way over time, right?
Yeah, these are perhaps coming from different galaxies.
So the only way that you would be able to do this well, I think, is by isolated galaxies, right? Or in a statistical way, which is going to be messy. Well, close in to the galaxy, I suppose. Yeah, but once you get too far out, it's going to be too hard.
What is the problem with an isolated galaxy? I mean, you need a binary black hole.
Let's assume.
Yeah. You can have a binary black hole and stick all in one galaxy.
Yeah.
And then, so just let me tell you. The deal is as these stars fly by, they create a burst of gravitational radiation, which is different than an M-ring. So here's an M-ring, nice clean orbit. You really have to care about the relaxation, right? And you have to accumulate a lot of orbits in order to make go from a capture to at least a signal that's an M-ring. But as these things fly by, they create a burst of gravitational radiation, and who cares what it does afterwards? It could get scattered, whatever, I don't care. I just care about the burst. And so people never calculated the number or signal-to-noise ratio of bursts in a galaxy. So I did this analytically, and it turns out this is a new class of Lisa source. You get about 18 bursts a year in the Milky Way, even if it's spherical, assuming the last one is always filled. But I'm going to assume that. Because.
So how is that different from what Mark Freitag did several years ago?
Mark,
I mean, I guess that was it was sort of the intermediate case.
Yep. These things overlap, right? So you can have a burst, and who cares what it does afterwards? Scatter, plunge, no M-ring, who cares? You can have a burst that evolves to an M-ring, which I think is more like what Mark did. Or you can have, if the flyby is too slow, or if it plunges in or something, it'll just be an M-ring that never was a burst, right? So these things are related physically, but can come from different populations. So that's it.
Different populations.
Sorry.
Isn't anything which becomes an Emery by the standard process started off as one of your bursts, right?
Let's see.
So it's part of the standard.
Yeah. Just like this Venn diagram says, right. This thing, right? If you were an Emery, you could have been a burst, or you could have not. If you were a burst, you could become an Emery or not.
Yeah.
Yep. How can you become a directly an M-ring? Your flyby is too slow. It depends upon the velocity. The burst of gravitational.
The star was bound to start. It was born with the black hole somehow, or born without the black hole.
Close, yeah. Or the flyby was really slow.
Yes.
Which means you put it close. It means it's not one of those hyperbolic orbits. Okay, I've gone over time. There's a whole bunch more stuff to talk about, and I'm sorry for taking so long. And I'm sorry that it took me a long time to warm up, too. But, I guess the three basic ideas. Sometimes you really have to worry about the shape of the galaxy, even in cases where the black hole has a very low mass. If you have a binary black hole, you can eject stars, and those stars will infiltrate the intercluster medium, and maybe an entirely different population that has a very interesting kinematic structure. And along the way, anytime you get flybys, you make bursts of gravitational radiation. And these things are observable, and they are a significant population in the Milky Way.
They're observable just in the Milky Way.
They're observable at the Virgo, actually, because the signal-to-noise ratio is on the order of 1,000. Yeah. Depends on how fast you go, but I can show you that.
I mean, even a single Emery.
Uh-oh. Grumble. Depends on the mass of the object, right? So you can have a few objects which are black holes that fly by really quickly. Appreciable fraction of the speed of light. Look, that's squared. Woohoo, that's the amazing thing.
How are you talking?
Quadruple.
Okay, well, we should talk about it afterwards. That's not the right way to do the signal to noise for a burst.
Well, we've worked with Louis Roubaud, who's a data analysis person who does this kind of stuff, and he does signal to noise ratio this way. And this is a mock-up of simplification of what he did. So we can talk about it afterwards. Okay, I've gone over. Thank you very much.